Welcome back to Creative Chit Chat. I'm Ryan McLeod. Hope you're all good. And enjoyed the little 2 week break. But now I'm back with more episodes, and I'm joined this week by graphic designer Duncan Barton, or Duncan with a 4, as you can sort of find him online. And he takes me through his journey from DJ CAD through to working as a graphic designer at the Union, and through to a job that was not really a job, which I'll explain, and then on to being a freelancer, and eventually then taking on a job during the pandemic, and now working for Local Skates, which is a rollerblade brand. One of the fascinating things that we sort of cover in the episode, it starts out at university when Duncan's sort of talking about how they teach you to be the, in inverted commas, the best designer in the world. Where in actual fact, when you get into reality and sort of churning out stuff every single day and meeting deadlines and working with clients and that sort of stuff, it's a very different reality of what a designer is and does. And that sort of job in designer, if you like, that's not really what you get taught. And he has this lovely analogy of it being a sort of a gradient from sort of art working and doing all this sort of boring little jobs and stuff that don't, and then all the way up to sort of highly conceptually driven high-end design, I suppose. And thinking about that as an actual gradient, is, I thought it was a lovely like analogy. We get into that a bit. There's also one thing that Duncan asked me to flag up, where he doesn't necessarily do himself justice and sort of misquoted something. So I just wanted to clarify that at the start. There is a TED talk by David Carson from 2013, which I'll link to in the show notes. And it talks about don't mistake legibility for communication. Where I think what Duncan said was, don't mistake readability for legibility. But yeah, it, I mean, it's all tied into the same conversation of things anyway. But anyway, if you are interested in that, which is, it's a great TED talk. I'll put the link in the show notes so you can listen to that. But yeah, let's jump into the episode. So this is graphic designer Duncan Barton.
When it starts, I've kind of always, I think, had an outlook which has involved design before I really knew what that was. I used to draw as a kid, you know, but with design things, I would like do top down views of the garden and like lay out these labelled patches of where different things would be planted, and I'd draw trainers and all that kind of stuff. So it was always kind of what I wanted to do, and I wasn't good at a great deal else. So I always did art at school and stuff, and yeah, that was kind of where most of the stuff started. Grew up in Livingston, that had a skate park, so I spent a lot of time there soaking in music and art and skate culture, and that all kind of led to all these other things.
And so, like, at what point did you take that that interest, or realise that that interest in design or creativity that could then be like an actual career path? Did that take a long time, or was that relatively?
Nah, I mean, I remember that kind of point at high school or whatever, you're going to your careers advisor and all that kind of stuff, and I was always pretty sure, well, I knew what I wanted to do from quite a young age, was I wanted to design. As soon as I knew what that was, you know, when you're really young, maybe you want to be a cartoonist or something, but you don't really know what that is. You're just engaged with the pictures and the colours and the whatever. It was my art teachers at school that kind of made me even consider what the difference between art and design even was, or maybe you would get forced to do all these, you know, just a big page with all your stuff on it, you know, and I would get compliments from one of my tutors that, you know, my presentations were great. You know, just the layouts of the things on the page. The things themselves, the drawings might not actually be that great, but I had laid them out well and the titles were good and stuff. So I remember him talking to me about graphic design, like the first consciously really thinking about graphic design and explaining to me about what it was. And yeah, I got a couple of really good teachers at Inverarmon Community High put me on it.
And then, so where did you go from there then?
So yeah, from growing up in Livy, I moved up to Dundee to go to uni and go to Duncan & Jorgensen. It was my first choice. Again, it was Edinburgh and Glasgow were just a wee bit too close to home for me. I quite fancied the idea of going somewhere else, and the design department looked good. So yeah, moved up here in 2003 or 4 to start going to Duncan & Jorgensen.
What was that experience like?
Overall, it was great. I mean, there was, but it was hard. The first year was tough because I was quite focused on design and I really wanted to get on with designing things. Again, having that early focus, you know, it didn't really seem like a great thing. It felt like a lot of waiting around to get the design started. We would get one wee module and I would throw myself into it and do everything, you know. And then we'd have to do, you know, a lot of still life painting or something. I was a wee bit less engaged, or life drawing or whatever. And I enjoyed doing all those things. Like, a lot of the things I look back that I was a bit grumpy about doing at the time have been really useful down the line. But at the time, I didn't get it. And some of my tutors were great. One of them in particular was really mean. So I was a bit burnt out at the end of uni. You know, I didn't leave uni with the same enthusiasm for design as I think I already had in first year. So it was tough, you know. Yeah, that's my lasting memory of it. My lasting memory of it is, you know, getting a half-decent grade for my class stuff because, you know, I think I had some disagreements with one of my tutors. But I got a really good grade for my my dissertation, which bumped me up a bit and made sure I passed and everything. Writing about celebrity endorsements, which actually, like looking back, like I was on the right path because it was basically about influencers. It was about niche celebrity endorsements, I was calling them, and it was all about how like getting Tony Hawk to promote your skate shoe is more important than getting Justin Timberlake to do it. These were relevant names at the time, you know, and I got a really good grade for that. So like, I've always just been on a kind of like marketing, design, advertising-y bent. I love art, you know, but I've always fancied myself a designer, more making things that have a purpose or some use or utility, you know.
So you come out of those 4 years a little bit jaded.
Yeah.
But then, yeah, you've obviously got to find that next step, that next thing, so... Yeah, how did you get that?
So after uni, yeah, I was a bit burnt out. I'd done retail jobs growing up. I'd worked in Levi's, and then I worked in Armani, and then I worked in Primark. But yeah, culture shift there. yeah. Well, I mean, to be honest, looking back, all the retail, I worked at Chew, and then Local Place Manifesto. But Primark was the best. Primark was brilliant because you just went in and you just did your job and then you just left. There was none of the weird social stuff or weird salesy, you know, got to hit this target, got to talk to this many people, you got to get, you know, just all these things that weren't very nice. Primark was great. You clean up for exactly half an hour at the end of the night. And if you know, when the half hour was done, you just drop whatever you had in your hand, literally let it hit the floor and you'd walk off. That was the opposite of Levi's. At Levi's, you could be there till 9 o'clock at night, take every pair of jeans off the wall, count them, put them into size order, put them back up in equal. But if that took till 9, you were there till 9. You know, so Primark was great. So after uni, I was doing retail jobs. I was working in Manifesto, you know, selling trainers and expensive clothes to football hooligans and stuff. And it was good that, like, at the time it was brilliant because my boss there was, like, I don't know, a really interesting guy who's a big art collector. Do you know the artist Futura? It's one of the biggest collection of his artwork in the world, and massive trainer collection and all this kind of stuff. So I got to hook up, got to do a lot of stuff with him, you know, got to go to London and do some of the cool guy streetwear stuff. And that led to, you know, some design jobs, you know, designing t-shirts for people and all that kind of thing.
So sort of running that on the side while still working, so I was starting to build it up.
Yeah, like it got to a point where I had been doing a lot of stuff for the student union, just flyers and stuff after I graduated. And then they wanted to take on someone full time. So I felt like it had been long enough that I was a wee bit less jaded on design, and I could maybe handle going back to the union. At the time, I was excited about getting, you know, a full-time design gig, even if it was just designing £1.50 vodka shot flyers or whatever. And I was there for a few years doing that.
And like, at that, I mean, I walk past student union posters every day, and I have done for years and years. And what amazes me is that, obviously, there's a small dedicated team or individual person doing like the majority of them.
Yeah.
But then I suppose what I'm interested in is, like, it seems like each poster has a completely like unique or different style. Because you didn't really want to duplicate what was there. People wanted something that was new and like eye-catching and different. But how do you continually do that and sort of switch it up and create the new style, new sort of approach every time?
With great difficulty. You know, when I started at the union, I was still, the things I'd been taught at uni were kind of like, I feel like at uni they really taught you how to be the best designer in the world. They didn't teach you how to be like a, you know, a kind of jobbing designer, you know, the kind of the nuts and bolts of how to do the everyday stuff.
The best designer in what sort of sense? The best designer in the world, sir.
Like, you know, you were taught the tools that someone working in London at a high-performing agency, at a high level in that agency, would need, but not necessarily the thing. Like, you know, you were taught how to work for brands. You were taught how to work for, you know, clients that you maybe are much, much bigger than you actually encounter. I don't have the stats, but you know, there's a small percentage at the top of design that make a lot of money, and there's a lot of people in the middle working for startups and working for, you know, sole traders and working for the wee shop down the road. And you don't get taught any of that, you know, and that was what a lot of the stuff I was doing at the time was. It was, you know, a poster for a person, and I was talking directly to the person, and they were the whole company. You know, it wasn't like, oh, well, make sure you get, you know, your invoice into the accounts department and all this kind of stuff. It was like you had to deal with real people directly. And yeah, the working at the union was kind of good for that, because you just had to, you know, it's such a convoluted mix of people there there was always too many cooks in the kitchen, and you had to just learn how to juggle that as best you could. The other problem at the beginning there was, like, back to my original point, I felt I was cut out, like, how to do really good design. So you were kind of, like, trying to force really good, in inverted commas, good design into this promotional flyer shape, you know, that didn't need or want it, probably, you know. And it took me a while to let go a little bit, and I don't think it was a bad thing, but to let go and let these things be what they are, and just like, I used that time to kind of get my muscle memory up and churning stuff out. I look back with a bit of dread now at the amount of stuff I used to just sit there and churn out all day without much thought. But it's a skill, you know, it's one skill. It eventually leaves you a bit numb, and it's hard to get the creative juices going when you do have something cool. That was something I ran into at the union a lot, because I was doing stuff for the reading rooms and then stuff for the union. And it might be an event that's on the same night, like, you know, and like, you just had to make sure you were, treating everything the way it needed to be treated, and not trying to make, you know, a union flyer a reading rooms night, and not trying to sell out
the reading rooms with some big cheesy, you know, price stickers or whatever.
Yeah, I mean, it's targeting that audience, right?
Yeah.
It's what will those people appreciate? What will relate? What will they relate to?
Yeah.
So yeah, I was going to ask, like, at what point does that, like, not become design anymore and just become sort of like art working?
Yeah. I don't know. I think that's a gradient. I think we talk about all these, the differences between these things, and it's never clear cut enough to, you know, to brand them all with the same outlook. There's a big gradient that starts at, you know, I don't know, shit polishing to artworking up to, you know, up to, you know, maybe you've got architecture and engineering the way up at the top of this, but like there's levels of importance, of danger, of, you know, whatever. Some things are just not as important and don't require as much thought, you know. Sometimes it is just a job that he's done. That's okay too.
So actually, I mean, we will move forward on your journey, but I just had a thought there. Is like you said that at university, yeah, you're prepared for this sort of high-end design, sort of big clients, big names.
I think so. I think like you're taught that like they care about Kernan, you know. Like nobody in the real world cares about Kernan. Like I think they notice it when it's badly kerned, but I don't think they know what they're noticing or why they're noticing it. You know what I mean?
Yeah. But then, so if you could turn the university experience on its head and say, give me the things that actually would have been valuable, or yeah, more of those things, what
more
would
real,
you sort of
real
pinpoint?
Stuff. Yeah, like real live briefs, real live clients, even if they're just like the things that, it's the same, but it's the things that, you know, YouTube people tell you to do now, you know, go out and do some fake client, you know, do some, but not fake ones, you know, don't just make them up. That to me, I think, is the biggest valuable, the most valuable thing was just the process of doing it. You learn so much that, like I was saying, you know, you didn't get taught how to deal with, you know, the cafe around the corner that needs a new logo. You know, you only picked up those things by doing it. Yeah.
But is there like, so could you pinpoint specific things? So I suppose you've said like sort of client relationship, dealing with the sort of smaller yeah. scale businesses or individual people as clients.
Or even just any of that, like paying tax or, you know, doing any of the kind of small business, your own small business stuff. You really never get shown any of that. You just got shown how to like immerse yourself in the brief and, you know, and then, you know, ideate and then refine and then produce. And that was it, you know, but that's not really, you don't always get to go through that process with everything. And allowing myself to not try and force everything to go through that process, probably freed up my brain a lot, I think, to actually do a couple of good jobs, you know, and still have something in the tank to do that with, because I wasn't banging my head against the wall trying to get some of these more commercial things to not be as commercial as, you know, as they are.
I mean, I suppose at that point in your career as well, it's quite a, still quite a formative.
Yeah, yeah, point. I'm still learning. I still didn't know anything.
And that, yeah, that sort of, your process is still evolving at that point as well.
Yeah. Yeah, process was pure, it was pure instinct at that point, you know. It was just, and luckily, I think my process kind of developed when I got to do things that I was really excited. You know, I was doing, there was a company called Soundcrash that one of my friends used to do flyers for. He got busy with it and passed them on to me, and there were these brilliant shows, you know, stuff like Flying Lotus and Daedalus, and I don't know, like things that, music that I was really, really into. So I was super excited to just, you know, oh yes, I'm going to sit down, I'm going to listen to, you know, every Flying Lotus album, I'm going to come up with some mad idea for that. And you could really pour yourself into it in a totally different way from, you know, I don't even want to repeat some of the names of the Knights of the Union. They're all cancelled now.
So then that must have had, the way you talk about it, a shelf life.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And so what was it? What was the turning point that made you say, right, this is, I'm done here?
Well, weirdly, I might not have left the union as early if I hadn't got another job. There was a bit of a weird one there where there used to be a company in Dundee called Tyco, made like sunglasses and cheap watches, kind of swatchy things. And I got a job for them. And I hired
you know, went through the whole process, leaving the union, hired two interns, the previous interns, to, you know, replace me to work full time and stuff. And then started my first day at that job and was getting shown about and everything, and everything seemed fine. Then I got left in a conference room on my own for a bit, and then someone, a wee woman who I hadn't met before, comes in and says, really sorry, there's been some sort of mix-up and can't actually give you this job. Are you serious? You know, it was a big setback at the time, because, you know, I had literally gone through this whole process hiring my replacements. I had another job offer from MTC at the time, you know, the web design place, which, looking back, would have been great because I would have actually learned web design, maybe. But yeah, so like, it was just because I got another job and because I was a bit scummered with, you know, the 150 vodka flyers and everything. But then that was what led me to start freelancing, was this setback, you know, where this job just evaporated. I mean, I probably dodged the bullet because the company went out of business, you know, not long after. But that was the impetus to start freelancing. It wasn't a choice. It was just because I had no job. You know, I really needed to get things going.
Yeah, I mean, I have spoken to quite a few people where a real dark situation or a real negative experience has actually led to a huge turning point in their life. But that's not without a significant amount of struggle. So I imagine, like, those first, like, that sort of dropping into the unknown must have been quite terrifying at that point.
Yeah, it was. It was my birthday as well. Obviously, it was a traumatic event. I walked all the way home. I can't remember, the offices were away up, you know, in the back of Dundee, and I walked all the way home just absolutely dejected. Like, what has happened here? Am I dreaming this? But yeah, so I was, that left me absolutely scummed. And I had to phone the union and say, like, can I get my job back? You know, and they're like, well, no, not really, because, you know, we've fired these other people. Maybe send you the odd freelance thing. Which I did do eventually, you know. I ended up, they did send me freelance jobs and started doing, you know, I would do their, like, whenever they had a big thing, like a magazine or something that needed done, I might do that. But yeah, it was just, that was what forced going full-time freelance and trying to really pursue getting my own clients and trying to get something a wee bit more.
So how do you... Right, so say, like, the day after your birthday or a couple of days after your birthday, you sit in your in your house and you think, right, what is the plan? What do you do? Where do you go? Like, where do you get work from? How do you start that?
Yeah, well, that was, I mean, at the time I was still doing flyers and, you know, all these kind of music things. I was DJing a bit. I was putting on nights at the reading rooms. So just kind of leaned into all that a bit more. I was doing a lot of, I'd started doing a lot of live visuals, you know, they kind of have the big screen behind the DJ. So I was getting more and more gigs doing that. I was getting to travel a wee bit to festivals and stuff to do that. And I probably wouldn't have had the time to do that stuff had I not been, you know, a bit in the wind, because I never would have picked up any of that stuff. There was a lot of that stuff just came through, like, following things on the internet. You know, I got some of the best jobs that I've had, like album cover art or whatever, have literally been just someone's posted a message on their Facebook saying, I've got a new album coming out in 6 months, I need a cover for it, and you'll send them in. And, yeah, I don't know, some of the cooler things I've kind of just got through really simple, like, someone asked for it and I sent it in and they were into it. So yeah, don't know, rambling now. it was what did I do? What was I doing in the dark times when, yeah, like, yeah, after, like, this job building? Yeah,
weird, well, was the thing,
it wasn't that dark, because, like, luckily I was making enough money to get by. It was, you know, scraping by, but, you know, it was the first time I'd ever had a bit of space to think as well, you know, that I wasn't getting up every morning and doing a bit of daily drudgery in some shop. Or, you know, whatever else. So it was good as well. It opened me up for a wee while to be able to do some slightly more creative things and learn some new skills, dig into, you know, projection mapping was a big thing at the time. I got a lot of gigs through that just because
It still looked like magic. Nobody had ever seen it shine a projector at a bunch of cardboard boxes and make it come alive. So yeah, I think it wasn't all bad, but it just, I don't know, thinking back now, which I probably should have more before approaching a podcast about it, it was definitely formative. It definitely, like, I can't say that I would have got into those things as quickly or as readily had that bad thing, you know, not happened. Yeah, I don't know, because I've never had a proper job since then. because I've been able to get by on this kind of weird mishmash of different design, visual, music, culture related things. And I guess I'm really lucky to be able to have eked my way by in that world. But yeah.
But then I suppose you've created or crafted that yourself or designed that yourself around your interests.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
You've sort of focused in on the, I suppose, the places where you had contacts, the places where you spent time, and then sort of then built a career around those elements, which is sort of like, some people would call it the dream. It's like you find those things you're interested in and then find a way to make that work as a career or as an income generator.
Yeah, yeah. But yes, it's like, if it was, it's a double-edged sword, because you can never have it the way that would make it better. You know, the thing that would make it better is more stability. The lack of stability is what makes it what it is. You can't really even out all the sides of it. You know, it's just kind of this constant find work, do work. And you build up relationships with people over the years, though. Most of the work that I do now, I don't really take on many new clients now for anything. Even if they're new, they've come through someone else that I've, you know, they know someone that I have done work for really well. I don't really advertise much. I'm lucky enough to get enough work to get by, you know, through my previous work.
And so how many years are we talking between that first starting out as a freelancer and then to now?
I graduated in, 2007, so it would have been a couple of years after that, maybe say 2010-ish, so about 2010-ish, and then, about 2014, maybe, I was at the union for a few years. Yeah, I don't know. I'm terrible with timelines. The numbers get me really mixed up.
Eight or 9 years, something like that.
Yeah,
as a freelancer.
Yeah. So, yeah. I've been in Dundee, I think, I'd only realised this today, but 20 years today. 20 years this year, you know. It was 2003 that I moved here. So, and I consider, even though that was when I stopped having a full-time job and having design on the side, design was always on the side even before the job, you know, before I even went to uni, I was, you know, designing wee websites and designing t-shirts and all that kind of stuff. So it was more of a continuation and more of a finally getting to do what the plan maybe had always been in the back of my mind, you know, rather than it being like a really conscious effort to do that and to rid myself of these day jobs, you know. I've got a day job now, so it's not worked that well.
But then did you not just say, like, 5 minutes ago that, what was it you said, that you've never had a proper job since?
Until pandemic. I'm trying to keep the timeline straight, but I'm probably getting, it's going to get Marvel movie-ish. During pandemic, I picked up a kind of, the first job that I've had in a long time that, you know, is, I would call a proper job. It's still working from home, selling rollerblades, but to me, that's a proper job. I'm on a pension plan and I don't have to do my own taxes and, like, I don't have to send an invoice. I don't have to worry about how much to put on that invoice, which is one of the worst things in the world for me.
And so was that, how did that job come about then?
It was just, you know, during the pandemic when everybody was working from home, and there was a big, this for a place, Local Skates, that I work now, they had a big boost during the pandemic. You know, everybody was trying to get outside for their 1 hour of government allotted exercise and everything. So bikes were sold out, skateboards were sold out, rollerblades were sold out. They did really well and managed to move into a bigger place. And I think just the kind of cultural shift to working from home meant that they, the guy that owns the business, kind of felt like, well, the stuff that I need done is all online anyway. So it doesn't, you don't need to keep a pool of people, you know, to nearby. They're based right at the south of England, and I don't know, it's near Eastbourne. They just advertised it. It was literally like, it's the same as a lot of the good design jobs. A lot of the good jobs, it's literally like someone put up a message. They put up a message saying we're hiring someone to do jobs. My friend, another friend that I know that skates, sent it to me. I applied it. All these, but it's not as easy as that. You know, the reason they get them when you apply for them is all the work that you've done. You know, it's all the knowing how to present yourself and knowing how to make your CV look nice. And, you know, I'm probably not doing a good job of it just now, but I'm going to write it all down and have a bit of time. I can make the story look pretty good. Like, yeah, he's done a lot of stuff. Yeah, he's done some stuff.
But then I think there was I can't actually remember, but there was a tweet a few weeks ago that I saw, and it was talking about how luck works. And how it's not necessarily this sort of mystical thing.
No.
It only works if you're open to it and you take, or you're open to opportunities. So the more that you can say yes or meet new people or go and experience new things or start conversations and those sorts of things, then that's when opportunities potentially come along.
Yeah.
But if you shut yourself away and you're in your own little bubble, then it's much more difficult for people to then had like for yeah, those yeah. opportunities to present themselves, if you like. And I think that to me made a lot of sense, and I think it relates to what you're talking about, is sort of you were doing a lot of that stuff even if you're not really mentioning it.
Yeah, yeah.
But there's always that like the network of people that you have, even if that's friends or professional, or that sort of merging. And
yeah, well, all these ideas of you know, luck or karma or whatever, you know, you get what you deserve, you get what you put out. Is it hard work or is it luck? And I don't know. Recently, I was reading a load of Marketing Bump about bothism. You heard any of that stuff?
No.
It's all about like this idea that it's mostly about marketing more than design and stuff. But I thought it was pretty broadly applicable. That like we caught up in all these arguments. Is it this or is that? Should we do it this way? Should we do a broadcast campaign, or should we, you know, target these people? Or should we do this? The answer, especially in this day and age, where the technology's available at your fingertips, the answer is usually both. You know, like, so is it luck or is it hard work? Is it, you know, chance, or is it where you put yourself? Well, it's both, really. You know, it's very rarely one or the other. You know, it's the culmination of both. There's a certain amount of stuff that you have control of that you probably owe it to yourself to try and shape and target and direct. And there's a bunch of stuff that you just have been dumped with that, you know, you have to learn to deal with, and you have to, you know, can't pick where your starting point is, you know.
Yeah, so do you maybe want to explain a little bit more about what that role at Loco is and how that works, and if it's, is it purely design or is it like broader than that?
When it started off, it was kind of customer servicey stuff mostly. You know, it was answering emails. It was telling guys in Egypt what size rollerblade cruisers they should buy if they're a, you know, whatever size shoe. But that quickly developed into doing a lot of the kind of branding stuff and wee bits of packaging and wee bits of they have like their own sub-brands or in-house brands. You know, they have a wheel company called Revolver and Go Project and a couple other ones. So doing a lot of the branding, packaging and newsletters and that kind of stuff, I started to had to learn how to do email marketing. It's not really a world that I've been super, you know, in tune with, but it's been really interesting, and I think it's valuable. You know, it works in this day and age where very few of the, I think you get less and less return on a lot of the social media stuff. a solid email list still, you know, can watch it. I know the people that are going to click it. I know exactly who I'm talking to, you know. It can target things really well without just through intuition, just, you know, by actually caring about the products. It makes it so much easier. So that's the day-to-day is like answering a bit of emails, designing something. One of my favourite things to do out there is we've got a wee t-shirt line called Local Labs, where it's like collabs, collabs. See what we did there? Bloody marketing genius. But that's like one of the funnest things because I get to work with all these people outside. You know, the ideas that we work with these companies maybe are in America, or we just did one with the guys in Nigeria and some other ones. And go back and forth. Instead of getting this stuff that's really expensive shipped over and then trying to sell it at a massive markup, you know, we work on the designs together and get them printed here so we can sell the stuff. But that's probably my favourite thing at work, you know, because it's kind of me and one of the other guys, wee baby, that we get to do fun stuff that's kind of off-brand as well, because it's, you know, a collab with some outsider. So yeah, more design than the kind of the day-to-day answering emails and all that these days, which is great.
And like, obviously at this point in your career, you've put a lot of work out into the world. So there are lots of physical or printed items that are out there in existence, right? How do you feel about seeing your work?
It depends. It depends. It depends massively. It can be the proudest or most embarrassing thing in the world, seeing your stuff out there. If you're into it, then it's great. It's none beats box of flyers that you're actually excited about showing up and busting them open and ogling them. But to be honest, it doesn't bother me so much now when there's crap out there that I've done. You know, like, I know what, like, I don't feel the need to be the best designer in the world that I mean, Unitutor wanted me to be. Like, and like, I know that was a functional job that needed functionally done. And I, as much as I like cool stuff, you know, I like utility, I like things to work, I like you to actually be able to read the date and, you know, read the venue and whatever. So I can rest easy in the not so exciting stuff that I know it works. You know, you can say what you like about subjective styles or whether you like it or not, but I can hang my hat on the fact that it, like, the file size was, you know, within what it needed to be, and it had the bleed on it, and it was in the, you know, it was in CMYK. Like, you know, there's a whole litany of just boring jobs that had to be done to make that ugly poster still. So I don't know. I love seeing the good stuff out there. Seeing the good stuff's brilliant. When they had another thing during the pandemic that kind of got me through, actually, was that nightclubs exhibition at the V&A, because I got a bunch of stuff through that. And had a wee bit in the shop, you know, that had a wee plaque thing, not a plaque, but I don't know what you call them, the wee stands that I've got a wee bit right. You know, it said Duncan Barton, and here's his posters, yeah, and here's a whatever. And it was in the V&A. It was in the shop, you know, it was not in the gap, but still felt really cool, you know. And it felt genuine. Like, it didn't feel like something that was just, oh, I feel lucky to get this. I did feel lucky to get it. I really appreciated it. But I did think I was the right person to do it, you know. Like, it did join the dots, or I did join the dots in a lot of the things that were part of that exhibition, you know.
Yeah, and I suppose it's like that celebration of all those, like, late nights and the years of hard work that went into however many 100%. Posters you've created up until that point.
Yeah. So. And that wasn't the goal. You never could have imagined that, to be honest. Couldn't have imagined the V&A when I first came to Dundee, you know. It's one of the, you know, all these things have kind of kept me here. It's Dundee's kind of constantly unfolding in ways that suit the things that I'm into, you know. It's pretty great.
And how do you deal with feedback? It feels like a bit of a sidetrack, but
I don't know how you got some. Well, you're podcast manners, isn't it? Not the most professional.
But I mean, it's an everyday thing, right? And people are always going to have opinions. You mentioned that about stylistic choices and things like that. But how do you deal with sort of? We mentioned this before the podcast, but like critical feedback.
Yeah, yeah. Well, to be honest, at this stage, I think I'm much better than I was at the beginning, because like I said, at the start of my, you know, if you want to call it a career, but around the time of graduating uni, what you thought the process had to be for every design wasn't, you know, really what it needed to be. So at the time you were getting feedback that maybe looking back was spot on, you know, but I still found it quite hard to hear, because it was like, I've spent so long trying, you know, when you get someone saying, you know, make this bigger or move that to there, it's like, oh, well, I've tried that. I've done this. I actually got 60 versions of this that I've not shown you, you know. And just realising that you don't need to go through all that process for everything maybe makes it easier. So the things I'm working on now are a lot more collaborative. Like, I really enjoy getting feedback. Like, the stuff that I work on now, the feedback is brilliant. You know, the feedback's almost part, it starts right at the beginning. You know, doing the research is already getting feedback from, like, what's this person into? What are they like? You know, it's not like a thing that just comes at the end. You know,
but that is that also because the,
and it's easier for me to deal with the feedback because it's not just like a thing that gets stuck on at the end now. You know, it's not like I've finished this and I need to either be able to get it across to this person in some sort of presentation or not. You know, or they just see it without even presentation. They might see it cold, it's just been sent to them, and then the feedback's coming back to you cold as well. And it's just, it feels cold, you know, it feels like, or it can feel like, oh, well, you don't understand this. And then you can doubt yourself because you're like, well, maybe I didn't explain it well enough. And it just, you know.
But then is that also because the people who are giving you feedback, maybe you have a better relationship with or more respect for?
Yeah, 100%. Definitely. Just taking on less jobs where I don't think I can provide value, where I don't have a relationship with someone already, where it just doesn't look fun from the outset.
Yeah, and I think
leads to being a lot easier to take when, because usually the feedback's great. Like, nowadays, when people give me feedback, it usually leads to great ideas that I hadn't considered. Whereas before, it felt like a kind of a wee bit more adversarial, and a wee bit more, you don't get it and I do, and I'm supposed to teach you. I think that's kind of what I'm trying to get to with the uni thing. I think that's what they got taught you. They get taught, they sent you out into the world as a kind of like fully yourself expert in a way. And I don't think that works much, you know, in the real world. It's not really that productive.
I think there is that thing when you come out of university, you're built up to the top of the pile. But not everyone has the appreciation that as soon as you leave that door, you're right back at the bottom again.
Yeah, yeah.
You do come across those who have this sort of confidence bordering on arrogance of their skills, but have no sort of industry knowledge, understanding, or experience at that point. And for me, the best people I've seen come out of DJ CAD or of any sort of art school, sort of at that junior level, are the ones that they're inquisitive, they ask a lot of questions, and maybe they don't actually have full confidence in their ability yet, but they have the underlying ability and they're willing to put the time in to work on it. And the sort of opposite sense, the worst are the ones who think they know it all, but maybe don't have the underlying things to back it up, like the sort of thought process, the rationale, the sort of the skills underlying that to produce.
Sure. Yeah, and that's probably a part of the tension that I think I felt, you know, this between appearing to be an expert and not knowing stuff. You know, whereas now I'm much more ready to be like, oh, well, there's this new technology that I think would be really interesting to use for this. How about I go away and learn it? And, like, you know, that's more like a productive conversation that we'd have now than just like, here's what I've done, hope they get it, you know. And And yeah, that makes it all easier to digest, I think.
So you've sort of, you've skirted around it a little bit, but so what is your design process now?
Yeah, it's interesting now because before there was kind of, it fell into two categories, the, like, you know, the good stuff and the stuff that needs done. And the good stuff, I would just totally immerse myself in whatever it was. And the bad stuff, it was just like set a timer. It's literally like get everything on the page, like, you know, try and nail down like what the musts of this thing is, and try and get all that on a page in black and white, and then just start massaging it into something decent. But that's when there's like, that's just a job that needs done. If there's a job that needs a good idea, the process is go away and do as much research as I can bear until an idea comes. Because I, like I said, I don't really work in one particular style. I try to come up with a style that suits the thing, or adopt the style that might not have been fully articulated, but I think is already inherent in whatever the music is or whatever, you know. You know, over the years you pick up, like, this type of music has these fonts, you know, like, this type of music has these ones, you know, this era of music, this was the kind of print techniques, and you just kind of follow that until you hit on something maybe a wee bit novel and exciting.
Because yeah, you're taking something that is audio and trying to create a visual language around that thing, which is not an easy, necessarily an easy thing to do.
No, it's easier, you know, it depends massively. It's weird because it depends on the type of music drastically, but the kind of broader electronic, techno-y, housey stuff, I often find it is kind of quite hard to do, actually, because it can be quite, not meaningless, but, you know, it can be quite abstract and it can be anything. And that's harder to me than, like, something that has a kind of historical reference point that you can dial in. Oh, right, well, these things look a bit like this. And then, when it's just, like, DJ such and such and a black background with, like, some 3D shapes, and it's... sometimes that you know, that's the look of certain scenes, you know, that's exactly what some of these people expect to see. But I think I struggle with that a wee bit more. I find it easier to something when there's like a bit of research and a bit of something tangible, and it's not quite so ethereal and undefined. You know, I like that type of music, but it's harder to design for.
And so how do you feel about trends?
I used to have a weird relationship with trends. I fancy myself as a pretty decent trend spotter. I think, like, I can see something coming, like, a mile. Like, I just constantly spot things, you know, three times. I'm like, that's going to be a thing.
And give me an example.
Oh, what's trendy just now? All the brutalist, you know, all the make things look like they've been printed, even though they're only on Instagram and all that stuff. That's literally what my work looks like in 2012 or something.
But then, like, so when you say you're spotting that,
well, because I never, you know, I'm not coming up with any of these styles. Like, it's purely doing a bit of research and, like, seeing, oh, well, this same thing keeps appearing, like, you know.
But then, so, like, even let's delve into that. So where are you doing that research? Where are you picking up those influences, the inspiration from?
Everywhere. Instagram, on the street, and also, like, I think you can watch the fluctuation of trends. So, like, for example, there's a period like Chuck Taylors are cool trainers, right? They're these skinny trainers, and then eventually it becomes Adidas Superstars that are a bit chunkier. And then it goes back down to, like, Adidas Sambas, and then people start wearing Nike Air Force Ones. Or you can watch it with jeans, you know, like, they get skinnier and skinnier, and then they get baggier and baggier. I think we're in quite a baggy jean era just now, you know. And it's always just, like, there's, like, maybe a tipping point, or, like, literally the word trend, you know, you could, if there was a graph to it, you could see it's going this way now, you know, and it's got... You think, oh, it's been that way for so long now. And if I'm sick of it, then there's other people in the world that are having the exact same thoughts, because we're all digesting the same stuff on Instagram, Pinterest, TV, whatever. So if I'm sick of it, they're probably sick of it. We're probably going to start getting off that trend and on it, you know. But the reason I say I've got a funny relationship with them is because I would kind of really closely follow trends. I'm always really interested in trends and what's going on. it was often to avoid them. It was often to not, to purposefully not do them. Maybe a bit stuck up, you know, because it was like, don't want to be trendy, you know, like, because that's uncool. That's like trying too hard or something. But now, I've kind of changed a wee bit, to be honest. Now I kind of see it as like an opportunity to try something else. It's like, oh, that's cool now. So like, I can do that. Even back with trainers, you know, I've got a massive trainer collection, way too many. And you can pull different ones out after a couple of years. It's like, oh, these are back now, you know, like, and you just reach into the cover and you're, oh, right, people are wearing Air Max 1s again. Oh, get my Air Max 1s on. And you just have this like bank of styles that you can tap into when they become, when it is their turn, you know. So now I don't mind that. I quite like trying to do something a bit trendy, because I feel like we're taught to not be trendy. We're taught to be, you know, strict graphic designers that care about leading and whatever, you know.
Timeless beauty.
Like, well, I mean, the trendiest stuff just now is all this really broken-looking stuff and stretch type and literally just, like, breaking the rules. You know, that's what I think is the most engaging visual flat graphics just now.
But then I almost feel like there's a point at which... Well, you talked about a lot about this, like, the sort of the functional elements of it, the readability, the sort of legibility, even, like, at distance or thing. And, like, I do find that trends often push against that too much.
Yeah.
And you get to the point where, like, I have no idea what that is or what it's for.
Yeah.
Hey, it looks nice, but...
But what was it? So I can't remember who it is, and I've probably got it the wrong way around as well, but it was like, don't mistake readability for legibility. You know, they're different things. You can get something without reading it. You know, you can... And it's sometimes the non-functionalness of it gets something across about it. You know, say you're trying to do some underground, you know, music thing. Making it very obvious and non-cryptic at all, you know, it's so, you know, just laying it out where it probably doesn't excite the person that's supposed to excite. It doesn't catch their eye, you know, something a bit more awkward. Maybe they can't read it, but maybe they'll actually step forward and read it, you know, because it's a wee bit more cryptic. And it's always just a balance. There's no answer to that. You know, it's...
Well,
have I gone too far? No, maybe I need to pull it back a bit. Maybe.
I would say it depends on the
audience.
Well,
at least for
right?
me anyway, because I want my cake and eat it. I want it to be trendy and I want it to work. Like, I want it to not try to be, you know, I want it to be cool. make all my other designer pals go, ooh. But I also want the client to be happy and I want it to sell as many widgets as, you know.
Yeah, but I mean, ideally that is, like, you, as you say, you meet the parameters.
Yeah.
Like, you do the functional elements and you bring the style that you want to bring to it. Doesn't always work, doesn't always happen like that, but ideally, yeah.
That's the worst feedback to get, when you think that you're providing, when the things that you're doing are like what they need, but they don't think that's what they, you know, they just want something else. And you're trying to give them what they think, what you think they need. When you get aligned on what you need, it doesn't go so badly, maybe.
Yeah, I often find that there's a horrible bit of feedback that is around people might not know what they want until they see what they don't.
There's nothing worse. Yeah. But it's true, though. And I remember, there was a point in my career where I like reckoned with that. It was like, right, you're really going to have to get into your presentation boards and you have to lay it out. You can't just show them, you know, the logo and then expect them to get it. You have to do it. You know, this is all pretty rote advice now, but, you know, your mock-ups and all, you're laying it all out and take ownership of presenting it, because, you know, otherwise they won't get it, you know.
Yeah, because it's not only your job to produce the end result, but you also need to sort of hold their hand and lead them through a story and actually sell them in on the idea before you then do the reveal and go, this is it.
Yeah. And usually if they've come along for that journey, you know, they're way less, they've got way less problems. They're way less likely to push back on stuff, you know, if it feel like they've been involved in it. So yeah, get clients involved at the start and try not to argue with them at the end.
So yeah, I wanted to jump back a little bit to something that you said maybe about 20 minutes ago. Around, I can't remember exactly how you phrased it, but like the Dundee has kept you. It's sort of captured you as lots of different facets unfold. So I wanted to delve into that a little bit, and like, kind of like, what did you mean by that? But also sort of like, what is it that you see unfolding in the future that will keep you here?
Well, yeah, I mean, just on a really basic, practical level, the things that they've built, you know, when I moved here, there wasn't a skate park up the road, there wasn't a V&A, you know, and all these things kind of happened. I think Dudhope got built 2004, 2005, and I moved here 2003, so, you know, it was just, you know, the year after I started. And even when I moved in the flat, it's just across the road from the reading rooms. I had no concept of that, you know, when I moved there, but there was, I just kept being, from, you know, I moved here and, oh, here's a nightclub that plays good music and has good people and has all that. Oh, here's a skate park, you know, you can now just walk up the road to go to a skate park. Oh, you know, they're going to build a design museum, you know, not just a museum or like an art museum even, it's going to be a design museum. And it just, I don't know, it made you feel welcome as a designer, as a skater, as a, you know, all these things that I was into. So yeah, it just, like I said, it's all those things. It's all the, some of the institutions that we lost, you know, in the reading rooms or manifesto or whatever. But there's, I just think that whole transformation in the front at the Riverside's been amazing. Again, tying up all these worlds, it's just got some of the best ledges for skating in Scotland, and they let you skate them. So you couldn't ask for much more than that. You know, that's on a, to me, on a level of like MACBA in Barcelona or, you know, South Bank. Or, this is, you know, this is a great destination now if you're into grinding along concrete. And you, and it's a design museum. I don't know, it's just mad. And then, like, the future, we could see where they're going to build this, suppose the, what do you call it? The Eden Project. Yeah, yeah, you can see that from our window, you know. So, and you're like, and I don't know, I got mad in at plants over lockdown. It's like, I didn't do the banana bread or the whatever, but I got well into my house plants. So even that was exciting, you know, that kind of got announced at the same time as I was going down this YouTube wormhole watching plant videos. So yeah, it just keeps, it keeps, Dundee keeps orientating itself to things that I'm into. As much as in recent years it's been a bit sad to see loads of things going, you know, Groucho's, whatever. But up until now, they've all been there. They've all been, I kind of, I feel like I just walked into these institutions and then they've added on to it.
Well, yeah, but I mean, you make a point, a really good point there. There's sort of, I suppose, three things you've mentioned now that have now disappeared. So,
yeah,
Reading Rooms is gone, Manifesto is gone, and Groucho's is gone. But yeah, I suppose the culture that's around them still exists.
Yeah, to a degree. I mean, I think you know, the Kings that kind of took up where the Reading Rooms left off. It's a lot of the same people behind it. There's still the music culture there. I don't know about. Yeah, I don't know where. We had a weird world at Manifesto because there was kind of, some of us were the kind of streetweary world, the kind of graffiti and trainers and whatever, and some of us were the kind of football hooligan Stone Island jackets and that. So I think the Stone Island jackets version of Manifesto is definitely still alive and kicking. But I think the streetweary thing that like me and Wilson and Boss are into, it's kind of just been evaporated into broader culture now, you know. Kanye West can be anti-Semitic and still sell millions of dollars worth of trainers or whatever. It's just, it's so, it's just air now. It's, you know, it's not a niche culture. And then Groucho's, you know, got replaced by 13 and Asai, and obviously it's not the same, but, and it's going to be a, they're opening it up again, they're going to make it a music venue, so that's cool.
So I suppose one thing to ask is like, what else is there that the city could be doing? Obviously, it sounds like he's texted all the things for you, but yeah, like, what, yeah, what have we still to do? What could we be doing better in the future?
I honestly don't know. It's a tough one for me because I think, like, sadly, over the years, I've found that a lot of Dundonians don't have the same rosy view of Dundee as I do. And it's, if you get outside of the city centre and you get outside of the kind of arty hubs, you know, it's not always such a rosy picture.
So I don't know. I don't think I'm necessarily the right person to ask. I think, like you said, it's provided me and continues to provide me like important things that I need and that make me want to be here. Also, there's like less BAMs in Glasgow and less TOFs in Edinburgh. It's lovely here. But yeah, I don't know. Doing something about the rapidly disappearing high street, like there's something wrong that we keep having these discussions about the lack of spaces and the amount of spaces that I walk past every day that are just sitting there empty, you know. You know, that Tesco, and like there's all these massive units, and like that big Marks and Spencers is about to close, and it's not going to, there is no plan that I can see or that I'm aware of to what's going to go in these units and what's going to take, because the high street's not going to come back. There's not going to be a way that they're going to save all these places, and there's not another Debenhams or one of these big brands that would fit a unit like that. They're just going to sit empty until someone comes up with an idea. So I don't know. I don't have an answer, but that definitely has been on my mind, because I think through AMPs and through this and through a lot of the different Crave Dundee things, spaces seems to be a hot topic, and it doesn't seem to be a lack of physical spaces, tying them up, getting them used, all that kind of stuff. I'm maybe not the person that knows how to crack that, but there's something that needs aligned there, you know. Because
and I think there's a whole other podcast series that we could spend.
Yeah,
discuss the debate and all that, and I think that it's such a complex issue, and I don't think it will be that one idea that does it. I think it has to be 10, 20 ideas and a sort of reimagining of what a high street is and does on a sort of fundamental level, and that's probably locally, like nationally as well, because we're not in isolation.
Exactly. It's definitely not just a Dundee thing. But it is hurting a small town centre like Dundee, because it is, you know, just because it is such a small town centre. Dundee's a big place, but from here to where I live isn't massive. And when you take a lot of the just daily traffic and vibrancy out of there, it doesn't leave a great deal.
And I think as well, it's a city where you have to really captivate and capture an audience as like a significant portion of that population, of Dundee's population, in order to make something work.
Yeah.
And especially now when you see the sort of run of businesses closing because cost of living is so high, people are doing less things essentially. They can't afford to do as many things as they used to like be able to. Therefore, those businesses are suffering because maybe you're not going out as much, or you're not buying an extra coffee or whatever that is. People's mindsets are really changing, so their buying behaviour is changing, and then well-established businesses are suffering and disappearing, sadly.
So yeah, something to do about that. But unfortunately, I don't really have the answers. Like I said, Dundee's been good to me, so.
Yeah, it feels like a really downbeat way to end that. But
It's not meant to be.
No, I know, sorry, I probably took it there. That is my fault. But maybe you can bring it back up with some recommendations. So the things that you've maybe been listening to, watching, reading or playing recently.
I had a quick think about this on the other one. I was struggling. I think the best doc that I watched recently, have you seen The Pez Outlaw?
Yes.
Oh, it's brilliant, right? Oh, excellent. Okay. Well, since you have seen that, if you've not seen that, go watch The Pez Outlaw. It's brilliant.
As in Pez, like the little
the wee Pez dispensers. Yeah,
and
yeah.
The story's unbelievable. The actual like style that it's shot in as
it's
well.
Brilliant. It's heartfelt. It's like designy. You know, it's like there's lots of levels. Check out The Pez Outlaw. And I don't know. Art and Copy. It's like a really old one. That's like my happy place. You know, certain when you've had a few too many drinks and you start putting on your old favourite YouTube videos. Sadly, Art and Copy is that for me. I like all the Doug Prey docs. You know, he did one called Scratch back in the day and followed pretty much every film he's made. But Art and Copy, when that came out, it's 10 years ago or something now, it's still I don't know, I could watch George Lewis bang on about advertising for ages. I'm trying to make these people money. He's at some raging about Tommy Hilfiger not being chuffed with his launch campaign that was a massive hit. You know, George Lewis, he's like the guy that is meant to be Don Draper in Mad Men, but he's not. I never watched Mad Men because I was at a design conference in Dublin and he was doing a talk and it was all about him. Mad Men was a load of crap and he's nothing like Don Draper. He was raging. So I never watched it.
I'd say even if it's not, it's still worth a watch.
Well, I eventually did try to get into it, but I never kept up with it. But yeah, I definitely missed out on it because George Lewis told me not to. But yeah, Art and Copy. Art and Copy is my happy place documentary.
And if anyone has listened to this and wants to sort of find you online,
good luck. you can find me up at Dudhope in the morning between 7 and 9 usually. I don't know, it's just Duncan Barton. Duncan with a 4 kind of became my DJ name and like kind of the branding of my real name online. So yeah, Duncan with a 4 instead of an A. Google it and I'm sure you managed to find something.
Yeah, thanks very much.
Thanks, Matt.
So thank you so much to Duncan for coming and doing the podcast. Lots of graphic design geekery this week. And another thing that I loved out of the chat that I didn't mention at the start was and I'm sure probably someone has done this already, but the sort of bagginess of jeans over time. I think mapping that on a sort of a graph or a visual where it shows the sort of leg width or skinniness of jeans over time, I think it was sort of fascinating, and the sort of the chunkiness of trainers and how that expands and contracts over decades. I thought it would be really nice. But yeah, again, another sort of really lovely story, and so positive about Dundee and all the things that he loves about it that seem to be tailor made for him. But yeah, so that's it for this week. But if you want to keep up to date with the podcast, it's at CCC Dundee on X and on Instagram, and it's facebook.com/groups/CCC Dundee. If you have been enjoying the podcast, if you've been listening for a while, maybe you could support it and you could buy me a cup of coffee. It's ko-fi.com/CCC Dundee. But yeah, until next week, bye.